Welcome to the Brian Kane Peak Performance Podcast. On each and every episode, Brian talks with coaches, athletes, and performers in all arenas who are putting into practice the principles of peak performance that will help you close the gap from where you are to where you want to be, to help you become a master of the mental game, and to help you start dominating the day.
This is Brian Kane, your peak performance and mental conditioning coach, and today's interview is actually being held in a restaurant, so there will be some background noise for you. That's how we get this done. And we're here with Sean Cotter, one of the top college softball coaches in the country, head softball coach at UMass Lowell. Coach Cotter, appreciate you taking the time to sit down with us here tonight during dinner and break it down. Could you give the listeners kind of your background in the game of softball and really in coaching? You've got a pretty unique background in how you got to where you are today as the head coach at UMass Lowell.
Well, thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me. And you know, I was fortunate enough that my dad was a longtime high school softball coach. He was 2008 National High School Coach of the Year. So how I kind of got into it was I was diagnosed with cancer my sophomore year of college. I was helping him. He was also a high school basketball coach at that time, so I was helping him with basketball. And he asked me to come to tryouts for softball to hit some fungo and help him evaluate some kids. And I figured I'd be there for a week. And almost 20 years later, I'm still here. So that kind of got me into the game. I was a high school coach for 3 years while I was a student at the University of Connecticut, and then I was very fortunate to get my first head coaching job at the age of 23 at what was then called Tecchio Post University in Waterbury, Connecticut. It's now Post University. I was there for a year. We were transitioning from NAIA to Division II. Then I had the opportunity to start the program at Plattsburgh State from scratch. I was there for 10 years. In our eighth year, we were in the World Series and finished fourth in the country. And this is now my fourth year here at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. I've had the great opportunity to take over a really good Division II program that's now transitioning from Division II to Division I. So after next year, I will have coached at every level of four-year college, NAIA, Division II, Division III, and Division I.
It's unbelievable. You know, and you mentioned how when you were at UConn, you know, you had an opportunity to observe practices with two basketball coaches that are very successful in Jim Calhoun and Gino Auriemma. You know, Sean, of all the great coaches that you got a chance to be around, either in softball or in basketball or any sport, what are some of the common characteristics that you see in the best coaches in the country?
Well, you know, whether you're talking about Coach Calhoun, Coach Auriemma, Coach Edwards, Bill Edwards at Hofstra, Coach Wares at Central College in Pella, Iowa, or my main mentor, Coach Clyde Washburn, who started the program at Eastern Connecticut. The best ones are teachers first, and they really take their role as a teacher to the utmost. And they look at, whether it's the court or the softball diamond, that's their classroom. That's where they get their kids better. And I think the best ones on game day then allow their players, because of the trust that has been established in practice, allow their kids to play. Certainly they're there to help the coach and to help get them in the right situations, but they allow their kids some freedom. And that's probably what I've taken away from the best coaches that I've been around.
You know, in terms of also athletes, let's shift the gears a little bit here, because I'm sure people listening to this will be both coaches and athletes. The best athletes that you've been around, what are some of the things that they do, you know, besides just being gifted maybe physically more so than their counterparts? What are some of the things that the best athletes that you've been around have done, maybe the, you know, intangibles that really anyone can do if they just really have a passion or a care for it? Is the foods being delivered great?
Yeah, you know, I've gotten a chance to be around some really good Division II and Division III athletes, but we just had a member of our staff who was with us for a year and a half, Jen Yee, who was runner-up for National Player of the Year in Division I softball 3 years ago. She led Team Canada in hitting at the Beijing Olympics in 2008. She just signed a contract, and she's over in Japan playing. And, you know, and some of the stuff that I took from Jen, and certainly our team took from Jen, is you know, her ability to prepare. You know, and so for a kid in Coach E, who, you know, came to us as a first-year grad student, you know, she had a doctorate-level understanding of hitting in the game of softball. And so I think the best players, you know, you can't teach athleticism. I think everybody knew when Jenny Finch was 14 that she was going to be pretty special athletically. But the things that then made Jenny Finch even that much more special were her ability to continue to get better every single day and to prepare. And I think that's probably the thing that college, high school athletes transitioning to college have the biggest struggle with, is understanding that the best coaches that they're going to go against, the best teams that they're going to go against, these are coaches' livelihoods. This is their full-time job. Their job is to prepare. Their kids are going to be prepared. So it's learning how to prepare and learning that the details are the most important thing.
Yep, thanks, Mike. Talk about the mental game. Now, we've had a chance to work together for a couple years, and obviously you've been a student of the game, as involved in with the NFCA and great mental game guys like Jeff Jansen and Ken Revizza. What does the mental game mean to you?
It means, I think all of us as coaches would say that, 80% of it's mental and 20% of it's physical. And we'll say that and the old Yogi Berra adage, and I think we all really believe that. But the reality of it is we probably, I think the best ones that work on it is probably 15% of what we do. And so we really do ourselves a disservice, and myself included in that. Talking with you today, there were some things that I took for granted with our really young team heading into the season that I just didn't do a good enough job with, and kind of put us in a position we weren't as successful as we wanted to be. So I just encourage anybody that's listening, whether it's particularly a coach, to take time every single day out of your practice to work what we call the above the shoulders, because ultimately that's what's going to win or lose you ball games, particularly when talent is equal.
Coach Cotter, one of the things I've heard you mention in the past is a study that was done out of Cal Berkeley about the Boston Celtics and the NBA. Or actually, it was about the NBA and how they tracked the amount of touches that happened on the court and the correlation between physical contact on the court between teammates celebrating successes or picking guys up after they get knocked down, and the correlation between winning. Would you talk a little bit about your understanding of that study and then how that sort of relates into your softball program?
Well, the study was done during the 2008 season when the Celtics won the NBA championship. And so they tracked, whether it was picking teammates up, pats on the back, fist pumps, hip bumps, chest bumps, whatever. And the Celtics had the most physical touches of any NBA team. And Garnett, who ended up being a big reason why that came about, and their focal point became about defense and toughness, really installed that belief into the Celtics and had an MVP caliber season. And then the Charlotte Bobcats, who were the worst at that, and then there's probably a direct correlation that they had the worst record in the NBA. And, so some of that is some of their own talent. I'm sure they just weren't as good as particularly the Celtics. But it also goes to, that winning mentality, that winners back each other up, that winners create a culture that says everybody's important in what we're doing. Non-winning cultures, that's just not as important. As it relates back to our team, we talk about role acceptance, role definition, role acceptance, and role appreciation, and those three things have to happen. As a head coach, you have to define what kids' roles are, and we talked about this today. Roles are ever changing, particularly over the course of a 50 plus game softball season, with highs and lows and injuries and matchups and all that stuff. But you really need to define roles for each of your players. You've got to get them to accept that role, and part of accepting the role is that their teammates are going to appreciate whatever that role is, and not only their teammates but the coaches. And it's the little things of maybe texting a bullpen catcher who's working her butt off for 14 innings that nobody's even seeing it, your team won two games, and letting her know over dinner that, hey, you appreciate what she's doing. I think those things go a long way to creating that culture of winning.
And you talk about the appreciation for different things, and sometimes, I think people mistake the difference between what's visible and what's important, you know, and a lot of times in softball, the things that are important are things that are not visible. And like you mentioned, the bullpen catcher was on there for 14 innings helping the team prepare to go out and play. People don't see that. Can you talk a little bit about visual versus important and the importance of making that clear for your team and having them understand that?
Again, the visual piece is, as you mentioned, my mom and dad might not see it in the stands. Their friends might not see it in the stands. But you've got to find a way as a coach to make that as important of a role as the kid that's hitting cleanup, the kid that's hitting leadoff, your number one pitcher. Because ultimately, those are the things that are going to dictate your long-term success. You can get away with some short-term success with not caring about those things, but if you're going to continue to get kids to play hard for you year in and year out, if you're going to establish a positive culture of your program and not just a team, I think there's a big difference between team and program. A team is in the short term, a program is sustained success. So making not making the visual things be the end all, but making those invisible things, the things that are behind the scenes, just as important, if not more important.
Coach Cotter, I really liked what you were talking about with the difference between a team and a program and building a positive championship culture. Could you talk a little bit more about creating that program year in and year out with that positive championship culture?
Yeah, I think it starts first with you have to have a vision for what your program is going to be. So I've had the opportunity to start a program from scratch, and I've had the opportunity to take over a couple programs. And you know, we're here at Lowell, we're in year four, and I had a 5-year plan of what we were going to be, and it kind of worked backwards from there. So from year five to year three to year one, and then what is our 6-month plan? What's our monthly plan? What's our weekly plan? And so once you have that set into place, it makes the day-to-day of what you're doing that much easier. The other part of the day-to-day is then taking what your plan is 5 years out and whatever on the way in, you know, whether it's year to year, and you got to sell that. You got to sell that to your administration. You got to sell that to certainly the players that you have, particularly if you're inheriting a program, because that's going to be, particularly at the college level, because it is fortunate that we get to recruit, but you probably don't get to recruit before you get there. So you got to sell kids on a plan that they might not see the end result to. So it's talking to them about the program is bigger than themselves, and they're going to be talked about with high honor, 3 or 4 years from now, to say that those were the pioneer kids that bought into what your original plan was, even though they didn't get rewarded for it. You certainly have to sell it to your staff. I think we can talk for hours about how you hire your staff, how you organize your staff. But to me, and I've never had full-time assistant coaches, but I would rather have loyalty more so than knowledge, because I feel like I can teach my assistants to be really good softball coaches. I can't teach their character of loyalty as a 25-year-old, as a 35-year-old, as a 50-year-old. So I think with starting your program and starting your championship culture, it's going to be, does your staff buy into what you're doing? Once you go from there and you've started to sell that, you got to sell it all the time, and you got to live it, all the time with your kids. We talk about dreaming all the time. When I first got here, we talked about our goal was going to be to win a national championship. Now that's at the top of our pyramid. That's not going to define who we are if we never reach that goal. But we've got to dream that goal. We've got to talk about what that looks like, what it feels like, to keep our kids motivated through those long hours of practice in January, those long hours of fall ball workouts. That's what's going to get them through it. My third year at Plattsburgh, that was the first time we put that on our mission statement, winning a national championship. And at the time, our team kind of laughed. And I was like, wow, I didn't think that was funny. I think this is realistic. And that was our first 30-win season at Plattsburgh. In the team that was the best team in our region, we were probably the sixth best team in the region that year. The team that was the best team in the region won the national championship in Ithaca College. And our kids all of a sudden said, maybe it's not that funny. And then 4 years later, the next class that came in, they were a win away from going to the World Series. 5 years later, we were at the World Series. So I really think that had a lot to do with it, that we talked about that. We dreamt about it. We talked about this is what national championship-type programs do, and they bought into that.
You know, and you've had a chance to go to the College World Series at Plattsburgh and be one win away from those, from going there with another team. What was the difference? Was the difference more of a belief and a mindset that we can go there, we belong there, we deserve to be there because of the work that we've put in? Or was it a talent thing?
Yeah, it's really funny. The 2006 team that didn't go, we lost in the regional IF game to Ithaca. That's the team that probably could have won a national championship. And it's just the way it goes. You know, on that day, Ithaca was just a little bit better than we were on that day. I think if we played Ithaca that year 10 times, you know, we'd probably beat them 7. But on that weekend, they found a way to beat us twice, and that's all that matters. It wasn't the best team. It was who played the best.
Yeah.
The following year, we weren't the best team, but we played the best the regional weekend. And, you know, ended up winning a couple games at the World Series, but just didn't have enough horses to win a national championship. And, you know, so I... that 2006 team, man, it was a fun ride. At one point, we won 23 straight. We were 40-9. We went from one home run the previous year to 46. It was a team that I really challenged that senior class. Our first meeting, I said, look, you're either going to be the most underachieving class in the history of this program, because they hadn't won a postseason game yet, only class not to do so, or you're going to write the greatest legacy that's ever been in our program, and they put a pretty good legacy. So really just came down to those two teams. Another team was played the best that weekend. We lost, we go home. The following year, we weren't the best team, but we played the best that weekend. And that's really all that matters. It is not who the best team is, it's who plays the best.
Now, Coach, outside of your office, you have a pyramid that is a hybrid of Pete Carroll's Win Forever that he talks about in his book. Could you speak a little bit to that mentality of Win Forever and the pyramid that's outside your office, why it's there, and what it means to you and your program?
Yeah, I read Coach Carroll's book, and it just struck me that his pyramid is everything that I'm about as a coach, and we bring our kids in front of that, and particularly our freshmen, and I talk to them about this is who I am, this is what our program's about, and the name of the book and the name of the pyramid is Win Forever, and it's not necessarily winning games forever. It's being a winner for life, and having that mentality. And if you have the mentality of a winner, you're going to be ultra successful within your life forever. So, one of the things that really strikes me is the three rules that we have that's on the pyramid, which is be on time. Excuse me. Be on time. Respect everyone. Fear no one. And protect the team. And those are the three main rules that we live by. From there, it talks a lot about it's all about the ball, and that we're either competing or we're not.
Coach Carter, you were talking about Pete Carroll's Win Forever. The three rules about be on time, respect everyone, fear no one, protect the team, and then you were talking about it's all about the ball.
Yep, so we talk about it's all about the ball. So in softball, it's a round ball that it's all about, whether we hit the ball, whether we field the ball, that's the game. So it's all about the ball for us. That's our sport. The other thing he talks about in his pyramid is that you're either competing or you're not, and a relentless pursuit of a competitive advantage. So competition is everything. So that's something that we've really tried to instill in our team, that everything we're trying to be the best at, we're trying to compete at, we're trying to set standards at. I know you talk about trying to be about the stopwatch as much as possible, and to try to have a winner and loser as a part of what we're doing within our culture. The other thing he talks about is practice is everything. And with practice being everything, that's where we develop confidence and trust. So on game day, we know we're going to win because our practice is everything. That's where we trust each other, and that's where we're trying to get our confidence. So we know on game day we're going to win, and we're not thinking about things on game day. We're just trusting and being confident.
One of the things that you guys do so well here at Lowell is that whole dugout participation, dugout intent system, where there's certain things that happen during the game as a part of the process that kind of elicit a energy and a response from your team? Could you talk a little bit about what is dugout participation and intent, and what does that mean to your team?
Well, we talked to our team about there's a difference between sharing and intent, and I think there's a place for both, to be honest. And but I think a lot of teams get wrapped up into organized cheers that don't really have anything based on systems or to help our team get a competitive advantage, other than that we're cheering and we're somewhat involved. Where with dugout intent, there's a real involvement in what we're doing. So an example would be when a player gets in a rundown on offense, we're saying stay in it as long as she can to try to help advance another runner up. On a pop up anywhere on the field, we're saying up and we're pointing to where it is. If it's for on the first base side, we're saying up one. If it's on the third base side, we're saying up three. If it's just up, it's up and it's in the middle of the field. With runners stealing, you know, on offense and on defense, I think where a lot of teams are yelling stuff out if a runner is going on with them on defense, where with us, because we run a lot anyways, if it's a ball in the dirt, you hear our bench saying yes, yes, yes to help that runner know that she's advancing to second, or no, no, no. We're trying to get into umpires' minds a little bit on a check swing. If it's us on defense, we're saying, yeah, she went. Yes, she did. If it's us on offense, we're yelling, no, she didn't. So, and one of the big ones we've taken away, and it's part of our system, is we're trying to push into every pitch. We've got our kids committing to every swing until they're not swinging. So we talk about good take, and good take doesn't mean they took a ball, so that's a good take. It means that they were pushing into their swing. They were getting to that, what we call the take position, every single time. So if a kid takes a ball, a strike, and she gets into the take position, we're saying great take. If a kid takes a ball and she didn't get into that position, you won't hear anything from us.
Like, so it's that whole be aggressive, ready to hit every pitch, because you're going to get a mistake. You just never know what pitch it's going to be. Yeah. So you got to be ready, and you got to be in that yes, 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 no mentality. And, you know, the dugout intent, although you're going to influence an umpire's call by saying yes she did or no she didn't or safe or got her at first base, you know, the primary reason is, like you've said, to keep your team into the game. Yeah. So you know if there's a pop-up and you hear two kids instead of 15 saying up, you know how into the game they are, and you can kind of try to reroute them, as we talk about, like you're the human GPS, trying to reroute your team or rattle their cage, whatever you want to say it. And get them focused back into what they need to do in that moment.
You know, and part of our intent, and you talk about the culture of winning and program, you know, things that we add in that's unique to us. We talk to our kids defensively that we never get beat below the glove. Somebody might throw a ball over our head. There's nothing we can do about that, but we never get beat below the glove. So we on balls that are low, we're screaming, pick it, pick it, pick it. And when a kid picks it, it's everybody in unison, good pick, great pick. And that's a part of our culture that we feel is important, that if we can avoid getting beat below the glove, we're going to win a lot of ball games.
Coach, I appreciate you taking the time. One last question here for you before we let you go. If you could remove the skull cap of all the coaches listening to this interview and plant one seed, one thought in their mind that would help make them successful, what would that one seed of knowledge be from you?
Well, it's that old phrase, it's the important stuff is what you learn after you think you know it all. And I think the best coaches are the ones that continue to evolve. That I know a guy like, you know, Mike Krzyzewski. He's a different coach in his 60s than he was in his 30s, and he was a really good coach then, and he's a great coach now, and if he stays in another 10 years, he'll be even a better coach then. So I just encourage people to get out of their comfort zone of what they do. I think the mental game stuff that you bring to the table, I think for a lot of coaches can be a little uncomfortable because it's not something that they have normally done. But I think we all realize how important it is. So I would encourage people to continue to get educated on their kids, to have an idea of. We all know how to break a kid down. I mean, that's pretty easy to do in terms of getting a kid to maybe not necessarily feel good about themselves or telling them what they're doing wrong. The great coaches are the ones that know how to build them back up and have a plan to build them back up. So I would just encourage all the coaches out there listening to keep getting better within their own game of what they're educating on and what they're teaching, and keep advancing themselves, but mostly to get better with that emotional mental game, because we all know how important it is, but we just don't spend enough time with it.
Coach Carter, appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to sit down and talk with us. Again, thank you for sharing your wisdom with the coaches and athletes that will be listening to this interview.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for listening to the Brian Kane Peak Performance Podcast. Please make sure that you visit briankane.com. That's briankane.com. And sign up for my Monday message, where every Monday I deliver straight to your inbox videos, interviews, articles, tips, techniques, and strategies that you can use to master the mental game. You can also contact me through my website on our Contact Us page and see my calendar of where I'm going to be in the country and when I'm coming to your area, so that we can get together and that we can continue to go out there and dominate the day.
The Brian Kane Peak Performance Podcast is part of the Top Coach Network. This is a production of Corn Belt Sports.